The America's Cup, first awarded in 1851, is the oldest trophy in international sports. It is a race of the most advanced sailing vessels of their day. Back in the year 2000, Oracle CEO and billionaire Larry Ellison needed a sponsor for his America's Cup team. As it happened, San Francisco's Golden Gate Yacht Club had fallen on hard times and was actually facing bankruptcy. They needed each other. The unlikely union of Ellison with the Yacht Club's Commodore, Norbert Byron, a car radiator mechanic by trade, turned out to be a perfect match. After a decade of trying, Oracle Team USA won the prestigious America's Cup sailing race in 2010 and will be defending their title this summer in San Francisco Bay. Thank you, Commodore Byron, for joining us this evening. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Mike.
And also joining us is Captain James Spithill, who was at the helm of Oracle Team USA's winning boat. It was the most extreme yacht competition he has ever seen, the 90-foot long by 90-foot wide Trimaran USA 17, and Captain Spithill was 30 years old at the time, the youngest skipper to ever win the America's Cup. This summer, he'll be defending that revered trophy in the unpredictable waters of the San Francisco Bay. And the woman who has written this great story is Julian Guthrie. She's a San Francisco Chronicle reporter, journalist, and author of the new book, The Billionaire and the Mechanic, How Larry Ellison and a Car Mechanic Teamed Up to Win Sailing's Greatest Race, the America's Cup. We're grateful to all of you to be here this evening with us and to talk about the America's Cup, including the many challenges facing all the teams this summer. So let me begin, if I may, Julian Guthrie, with you, and talk about what drew you into the story. It was an unlikely alliance, and I know you were very compelled to tell this story, but what was it that first drew you in the genesis?
Well, it's not very often that you get Larry Ellison, the billionaire, and a radiator repair shop owner teaming up. So that was a pretty fantastic starting point. But it was really this, you know, it's a very, there are a lot of points to the story. There are a lot of different parts to the story. But I was drawn in by these two really compelling characters, and they seem so different. But in the story and in my reporting, I found out that they aren't so different after all. So they were going after the oldest trophy in international sports. They had this singular quest, but they were coming at it from very different places. And this guy right here did something pretty heroic in reaching out to Larry Ellison and saving his yacht club and becoming the sponsoring club of Oracle Racing. And their friendship has endured to this day, and their partnership has endured to this day. So that's how I started. And then I started to get into the history of the America's Cup and these really amazing boats and the story of people like Jimmy Spithill and Russell Coutts and a whole colorful cast of characters.
You took
on
a monumental project, particularly for somebody who was a bit of a neophyte when
neophyte,
it comes to navigation,
yeah.
When it comes to all of the things that have to do with the mechanics and the design and the structure of these boats and so forth, as well as the history. And again, kudos to you for doing such a job.
Well, the more I learned, the more I was researching, the more captivated I became by the people, by the drama of the America's Cup, for the history, by the building alone of these space-age flying machines that Jimmy knows very well. So I was really, really drawn in. It was a great project to work on. A steep learning curve, though, as you suggested.
Yeah. And Norbert Byron, some where I come from would call it chutzpah to go to Larry Ellison and say, hey, you want to partner up with me? I'm a radiator mechanic.
In actuality, I gave a call down to his Redwood Shores office. He didn't let me speak to him the first time.
But
with the power of the internet, though, we got a hold of each other, and he got himself a cheerleader, and we got ourselves a team.
And at this point, the Golden Gate Yacht Club, I know, was in trouble, as I said in the introduction, financially, maybe even at the brink of bankruptcy. But at the same time, it was a kind of daring thing to do. There were not many, there were certainly club members who wanted to be financially solvent, but there were some who were opposed to the idea of this alliance, weren't there?
Well, there were a few of the old-timers, and I, with all due respect to them, they wanted to see a club that started in 1939 continue on the way it was. But like you said, we had some extreme debt, which I didn't know about till the day I took over. And figure that one out. But we gave it an honest shot. We tried a couple of ideas, long-term plans, but didn't seem to work out. And when I read about Mr. Ellison actually not making a deal with our neighbor down the street, the St. Francis, I thought I'd give it a try and talked to a few of our people. And basically what I got from them was you know, it's not going to happen, and that's the way it is. And I said, well, I don't want to hear from people the way it is. I want to see what we can do and change what it is. And lo and behold, we got in contact with each other. We did some negotiations for 2-3 months, and we became the challenger for the America's Cup in 2001. So a little engine that could got out of the debt, and we moved ahead, and here we are today, the sixth trustee of the America's Cup. Yeah. Kind of cool for San Francisco.
Maybe, Julian, before we talk to Jimmy Spindle, you can trace a little bit about why it didn't go over with the St. Francis Yacht Club, which is where Ellison first thought he would plant his flag, so to speak.
Okay, first, how many members of the St. Francis are here? Just kidding. No, it was really about control. And, you know, Larry Ellison is in a position in his life to demand, ask for, request, want control. And the St. Francis is in a position also as a very prestigious, accomplished yachting club to expect control as well. And you can't have two people in total control. And it was pretty much as simple as that, mm-hmm. that you couldn't have a relationship that would work out. And lo and behold, right down the road was this little engine that could, the Golden Gate Yacht Club. So it worked out the best for everyone. So it was, and now everyone is benefiting. The St. Francis is benefiting from what the Golden Gate accomplished. And so I think now there's a lot of collaboration between the clubs, which wasn't always the case.
And how does an Australian skipper become head of the USA?
Oh.
It's a popular question, that one, actually. I started at a young age. I got into sailing really through way of life. I grew up, it was like a small island. And so to get to the mainland or get to school, we had to go by boat. So I was forced into it, I guess you could say, and really just did it for fun. I mean, when we came home from school, we couldn't get television or any of that. So that's what you did. You're on the water and you're into boats. And it really, through a bit of good luck along the way, it led to the opportunity today, being involved with Oracle Racing or Oracle Team USA today, and being in San Francisco.
Do you almost? Your story is almost one of mythic proportions. You were a 4-year-old kid when the Aussies won, right? And you were sailing to school, as I understand it, as a kid.
Yeah, I mean one of the crew members that sailed on Australia too, he actually trimmed the mainsail. He lived in the same area where I did, and obviously I was quite young when they won, but I vividly remember this endless party in Australia.
Yeah.
It was just, all I remember was, you know, we sort of lived up on the hill, so you'd have to walk up from the water to, you know, get up to the house, and just have this picture of Mum and Dad trying to walk up the hill, you know, after being over at Colin Bushell at the Bushell's place, obviously partying. So yeah, I mean, it was just such a euphoric moment for Australian sport, and it really is one of the biggest milestones in Australia, you know, for sporting achievement, but the whole country was going through a recession, and it were really tough times, and it really brought the nation together and showed that, hey, we really can take on anything, if you put your mind to it, even a powerhouse, you know, of what America is. So it was a big day for Australia and obviously for sport in Australia.
Well, here you're the youngest skipper in history, 30 years old. I'm always reminded of the end of The Great Gatsby when Nick says, I'm 30 years old, I'm too old to lie to myself anymore. You had, even as a kid, conceived and imagined that this would be what you would achieve. And I just wonder if you could give us a sense of what that triumph and what that ecstasy meant to you.
Yeah, it was a lot of, from a young age, it's all I really wanted to do. I remember telling my dad at a very young age, that's what I was going to do, and I was going to win the America's Cup, and, you know, he just sort of said, yeah, okay, good on you, you know, like. But, yeah, I mean, it's something I've just worked really hard on, and it's just been the goal, and it's something that's more of, I guess it's a bit of an obsession, to be honest. You know, if you ask my wife, she'd say it's an obsession, but it's something I live for, you know. I just can't wait to get up every day and do what I do, especially now where the game is today. And it's, yeah, I mean, when you finally do achieve this goal that you work so hard for and so many people, these teams are over 100 people, and you pull it off, it's somewhat of relief, and then thinking about winning the next one. You know, it goes, it's so addictive, I guess, is the word. It's an incredible game and an incredible experience.
Can you tell us about what the competition looks like from your perspective now as far as defending the Cup?
It's tough. I mean, Team New Zealand, Emirates Team New Zealand, are the toughest challenger right now out on the water. Very, very polished. You've got a team that's been together for over a decade. That core team's been training together. And anyone that's worked in, competed in sport knows that it's very hard to shortcut spending a lot of time together. You know, that sort of, you get to really tight situations or pressure moments where you can just tell what someone's thinking because you've been through good moments, bad moments for a long time. Very hard to shortcut that sort of a thing. But having said that, we have a fantastic team. We've had a couple of years racing against all the other teams on this America's Cup World Series circuit. We obviously raced in the last America's Cup where we were successful. So we have a great team behind us, but it won't be easy. It's going to be a fight on the water. It'll be a battle. And look, we're gearing up as best we can, so we are as best prepared as we can be come September.
Julian, talk about those magnificent moments. I mean, here you wrote this book, which is a history. It's also a narrative, a very compelling narrative. As I said, it almost reads like a novel. You're right in the eye of a hurricane initially in the first chapter. He gave you the tiller, though, didn't he?
He did, and that was on an AC-45. And people ask me if I sail, and I just say, I sailed with Jimmy Spithill on an AC-45, and that's like as good as it gets.
It's a conversation stopper.
Yeah, no, but, I was back clutching to the netting, getting drenched by the waves, and he said, Guthrie, get on up here. And so he let me drive for a little bit, but he had this great line, and that was, Guthrie, you crash it, you own it. And I was like, ah! You probably say that to everybody, you know.
It's true.
But that was a thrill because you have this technological wonder of these boats, and yet you're immersed in the beauty of nature, in the crashing waves, and the Golden Gate Bridge was not far away, and the great Russell Coutts was not far away either, racing right beside us. So that was a moment I'll remember forever, and that I could understand how amazing this is and how addictive it is for sailors and for, competing at not that I was competing, but why he loves what he does. It's a very cool thing. I loved it.
Of course, as you point out in the book, a lot of it's the technology, a lot of it's the competition and the whole preparation up to the race and so forth. But there's some luck involved, too.
Oh, there is. There's, and Jimmy could probably talk about that a little more, but I think now the luck part of it has really been minimized, mm-hmm. because the science part of it is really maximized. I mean, the science part of it is so incredible, from predicting the weather to the currents to understanding the every bit of the science of the boats, and it's a well-oiled machine, although they may not even use oil.
Can you talk over a bit about the new technology? I mean, they're comparing these boats out there, and we'll talk about why they're designed differently and why they're comparing them to the Indy 500 and that sort of thing. I mean, these are really fast, and a lot of people are concerned about the safety and the design, especially after the Artemis tragedy, which may have been a little fluky, but still, nevertheless, has put people mindful of this.
Yeah, especially since the Artemis tragedy, which is still under investigation, and with all due respect, we're still waiting for some results on that. But the technology that has come out of these multicats is just tremendous. It is the future of racing, I think. There was a time period a few years ago when we, after we won the America's Cup in 2010, that when we were deciding the protocol, we didn't know which way to go with the monohulls or with the multi-hulls. What we did under Russell Coutts and Jimmy and Larry, we took a group of non-sailors, sailors, general media, brought them over to Valencia, Spain, and we took them out on the water, race against with 240-foot multi-hulls and 240-foot monohulls. And basically it was what was more exciting for everything. And by the end of the month, or a month and a half if I remember, it was just hands down that the multi-hulls were the most exciting part out there. With that in mind, the design team started to get together, and they came up with some magnificent boats, the 45s as a platform, the one designed for all the teams to train on, and of course the 72s, which have to be built in-country of the Challenge. Ours, of course, were built here in Pier 80, as a matter of fact. And these boats are just technologically advanced. They are the future of racing. Will we maintain and stay with them after this race? I'm not sure. But what we learned out of this, what we learned out of technology, it goes further on to the everyday sailor, too. I mean, to the recreational sailor who's going to be out there on their boat on a weekend thing, what we can learn from the designs and pass on to them is for the good of boating and the good of sailing for everybody.
Skipper, how do you feel about the fact, though, that you don't have the number of competitive boats in the race that perhaps many had hoped for?
Yeah, interestingly enough, in the past campaigns I've been involved in where we've had 10 or 12 teams involved in the monohulls, there was only really one, maybe two teams that were actually going to win, because there was a big difference in the sort of the people, the resource available, what was out there. This time, any one of the challengers could win. And okay, Artemis are dealing with an issue right now, so you know, probably got a steeper hill to climb than certainly Luna Rossa and Emirates Team New Zealand. But this is the first time I can remember where pretty much all of the challengers have got a shot at it. You know, we've got ourselves, Emirates Team New Zealand, Luna Rossa, and if Artemis can, you know, get back out there and get back on the horse, man, I mean, all these teams have got a lot of depth, a lot of talent, have all got the resource, all got the technology, and it really is one of the most competitive one I've seen.
And how confident are you about the safety of the design?
Well, we're confident. It's a brand new design, obviously. But look, I mean, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to go through life completely risk-free. I mean, but that's another point. I mean, the fact is, we'll all get in our cars tonight. It won't be risk-free, unfortunately. You know, we've got seat belts and we do the best we can, but you can never eliminate 100% risk. In our game, and one thing I really enjoy in sport and certainly where the game's heading now is, you know, you really try and push yourself as an athlete, both athletically but also sometimes taking yourself out of your comfort zone, you know, and doing something less than ordinary. And it's during those times where you do, you know, learn about yourself and learn about your teammates as well. But no, look, we've got some of the best guys in the world. Our engineers, our boat builders, they are the best in the world. They're an amazing bunch of guys. And look, like I said, safety is in the forefront for us. But look, every single sailor that gets on that boat, he makes that decision himself and understands that, and he does it because he loves it.
You have to be in top physical shape, almost like ballet dancers or top drawer athletes, don't you? Top tier athletes, yeah.
It is. I mean, that's the big change. And one of my, you know, I've got Tom Eamon here, and he and I do a lot of talks, and he's heard me say this line a lot, in that it really is the best of the best now. I mean, in the past, in the monohulls, you would have seen Dennis Connor and a few guys like that who didn't look like your sort of average athlete, you know, if you mention the word athlete. But nowadays, there's no hiding. I mean, you are so understaffed on these boats. You could have the best tactician in the world, but if you're not a great athlete, you're just not going to make it. You're going to, you know, you really stand out, and vice versa. You could have the strongest man in the world, but if you don't have a tactical, strategic mind, if you're not great in your feet, and if you can't think a step or two ahead, you're just not going to make it. So it really requires the best of the best.
Can I ask all of you about what's unique about sailing here on the San Francisco Bay, or what's perhaps most challenging about it? Some thoughts, Julian? Begin with you.
What is the most challenging
for this kind of a race that we're talking about? Obviously, I mean, what?
Well, it's a very tough place to sail.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to be a very accomplished sailor just to get out there as, I think, a hobbyist. But I think you also have, you know, the good part of it. You have this spectacular natural amphitheater of the San Francisco Bay, and I think that, you know, what I saw when I was out that day with Jimmy, which I keep going back to, is the beauty of it. You know, the beauty of the Golden Gate Bridge and the Marin Headlands and the Marin County and looking all around you. I mean, I think it's as beautiful and it has so much to offer as it is, on the flip side, challenging.
And maybe the Commodore could talk about some of the best places to view the race.
All along the waterfront, from Crissy Field in front of the Yacht Clubs, Fort Mason, all the way around Pier 39. It's the beauty of it is you can watch it for free, or you can do a little higher up, you know, a special seating at a spectator stand. But what's going to be great about these boats, they're going to be coming right by you at pretty high speeds. And you'll be listening to these sailors saying some unmentionable words, most likely. And,
not Jimmy, I'm sure.
Not Jimmy, no, he's Christian. But we've got, these boats right in front of you, sweat dripping off their face. It's going to be very, very exciting. I think it's going to be one of the most exciting America's Cup in the history of its 162 years. So,
You all excited about it?
Yeah, he's going to watch.
Well, let's hear from the skipper, though, I mean, about the challenges of sailing here and racing here.
I mean, it's the ultimate. I mean, these boats, they're the fastest boats in the world. You're on, it's kind of like a mountain climber going to Everest, really, you know, where, as Julian says, it's probably one of the most beautiful things ever. But just in an instant, bang, it can reach out and really grab you, you know, or try and knock you down. And we've experienced that. You know, we've flipped over one of these AC-72s at the end of last year, and we copped the wrath of the bay. It turned on us. But it is such a challenging and demanding place to sail. I mean, it's got the beauty of those iconic landmarks, Alcatraz, etc. But then you've got the currents, which are different every single day. The wind's always different. You've got fog. There's the commercial traffic. There's just the, you know, people out there enjoying the bay, and it's such a tight, confined area. You know, for us on these boats, it feels like we're in this cage. You know, but this wild animal, and it's just in this cage, and it doesn't let up. But it's, man, after a day, like today for us, after a great day on San Francisco Bay, sailing, really getting pushed, it's so rewarding, you know. And I sort of liken to that sort of mountain climber, going up and scaling one of those big peaks and then getting down. It's just, it really is the ultimate test. And any sailor or anyone that's on the bay, when you come to the bay, you're sort of preparing yourself for it, you know, and you're expecting a bit of a challenge out there. And it is such a rewarding place to sail.
You're going at what kind of speeds now in terms of knots?
We're doing, just 2 days ago we did our top speed, which was 45 knots. And that was in about 18 knots of wind. So, you know, we're doing quite a lot more than, you know, over twice the speed of the wind. So very, very fast, you know, very efficient. I mean, the big thing on these boats now is we have these solid wings in the air, just like a plane wing. But the real development is these foils. We're lifting the whole boat out of the water. And that is so efficient drag-wise, and that's what allows us really to reach these speeds. But the boats are amazing. They're so powerful. I mean, in 5 knots of wind, we can, you know, fly these boats, fly a hull. And then, you know, you get up to sort of 20 knots of wind and or even a little bit more. So it's, yeah, they're very, very powerful.
Julian, in your book, you had special access to Larry Ellison. He hasn't given interviews in years, and you were able to tell his story and his role in all of this, preeminent as it is. But you really give equal time to Norbert here, and deservedly so. I mean, it certainly is both of them. I mean, there's a lot about Steve Jobs' relationship
right.
with Larry Ellison, but both of them are the central protagonists of your story. And both of them, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people on the crew. There are a lot of mm-hmm. sort of characters who really make up the victory and the whole world of it and everything. But what compelled you to want to, for example, you get into his Yugoslavian background, Croatian
right.
background, and all his relationship with his father, and I mean, there's a lot of grist for the mill there.
Well, it's personal stuff. It is. It's very personal about Larry, and it's very personal about Norbert. And I, you know, in learning about Norbert's story and his father's story of fleeing Yugoslavia under Tito's dictatorship, and fleeing in a boat, and making his way to America, and making his American dream, I was touched by that. And then when I got to know Norbert and understood this story as it pertains to the America's Cup for Norbert, I felt that this was Norbert finding his own slice of the American dream. And what he did in helping to bring the America's Cup back to America was pretty profound. So I thought that this was this wonderful, seemingly ordinary guy, and that he's not a billionaire, doing something really extraordinary. And, you know, I found his story very, very powerful. And also, obviously, the juxtaposition with the billionaire and their partnership and their friendship and how they kind of play against one another, but are very complementary. I think that Larry Ellison is grounded by Norbert, and I think that Norbert is inspired by Larry. And so it's this really wonderful collaboration.
That,
yeah, it is very symbiotic.
So, Norbert, didn't you once say something about Larry buzzes by in his private jet over the Golden Gate Yacht Club or something?
Wrong thing to say, I think.
A little bit of class difference there.
Maybe. But no, I did see him come by one time overhead on his way to Point Reyes on his jet. But now Larry is a great gentleman. I think what he's done for the America's Cup in the last 10 years, especially the last 4 years, has just been astronomical. For us to have it here in San Francisco, we had to go through a little battle, actually in New York, I understand, and we overcame that and in 2010 brought the cup back here. Larry came up to me after the book, and he said, you know, I didn't know a lot of things about you in the book. I didn't realize this. Why didn't you tell me? Well, Larry, you know, it's not things I really talk about. And I said, well, the same thing goes for you, and especially his relationship with Steve Jobs and everything. We both learned a lot about each other over the last 10 years, but I think that this book was really amazing for both of us to find out a little bit more about our closeness and actually our parallel roads over the last 12 years.
She made you into a hero.
Far from that.
Let me go back to the skipper for a moment. What's the advantage of being the defending champion? There are a lot of advantages because you can specify many of the things beforehand, right?
Well, one advantage is you're in the final. I mean, you've effectively, that's nice. You've got, the odds 50-50. So, I mean, that in itself is kind of a double-edged sword, though. I mean, the fact is all that challenger that wins has gone through a full-on a battle. You know, they've gone through a full competition, they're race hardened, and they're straight out of that at their peak taking us on. Now, we're not allowed to race in their Challenger Series, so effectively we have to try and emulate that in-house. And today, interestingly enough, was the first day we've had two AC-72s out on the water, our own two boats. Every team's allowed to build two boats. Obviously you're only allowed to race one during the event, but so for us we have to try and emulate what the Challengers get in-house. So we have to have two sailing teams. We have to, to run and maintain these boats is a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a big commitment. So, yeah, I mean, it's great being the defender. It's, like I said, it's great being in the final. But, I mean, the big thing that I've seen having, moved to San Francisco is how much the city gets behind its home teams. I mean, we've made some partnerships with the Giants. I've gone out to a lot of the Warriors games, et cetera, et cetera. But when we had these AC World Series events here off Marina Green in the smaller boats, just that energy and that you get from the home field advantage is very, very difficult to put a number on it or a value, but man, does it. I mean, when the guys have got nothing left in the tank and they just need a little bit extra, and we can hear everyone cheering because we're going right near the shore. It's huge, and I really think we've been very successful on this World Series, especially at the events, in San Francisco. And I think that's one of the key reasons. I know that's a long answer, but I think one of the biggest advantages we have been the defender is that we're, San Francisco's team and there's a huge amount of support behind it. I really think that's going to be a big factor.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking to Jimmy Spithill, Oracle Team USA skipper, to Norbert Byron, Commodore of the Golden Gate Yacht Club, and to Julian Guthrie, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of the new book about the Oracle Team USA called The Billionaire and the Mechanic, How Larry Ellison and a Car Mechanic Teamed Up to Win Sailing's Greatest Race, the America's Cup. And you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV. I'm Michael Krasny, your moderator. And I thought I'd bring in some of the questions that are coming up to us, some very good ones. Skipper, I'll go to you first. Is there ever too much wind for safe sailing? One of the members of the audience would like to know, and another member would like to know, he's actually quoting a sailor friend who says, if you have to wear a crash helmet, it ain't sailing. What would you say to that?
Feels like sailing. Feels like flying, actually. No, look, I mean, these boats, they're very powerful. I think what would be a really, good thing out of this whole experience and what's happened, we've obviously capsized the boat, there's been the tragedy with Artemis, but a lot of the things that get learned in the America's Cup flow through the rest of the sport. And I'd say as a sport, we're probably not as prepared from the safety aspect, just in general. We haven't really looked at it that hard, I mean, it's obviously, it hasn't reached this sort of auto level kind of attention to detail when you think about the safety side. And after the tragedy, we did look at sailing, all sorts of sailing and where tragedies happened, and I was surprised at how large a number it was. So what I hope is a lot of these lessons that we're learning, whether it be crash helmets, whether it be these air tanks, do flow through to the rest of the sport. I'd like to see, be good to see kids I mean, interestingly enough, once we started wearing the helmets, we started getting photos of kids sailing their little Optimus putting helmets on, you know, because they thought it was cool. But then, when you think about it, you know, how easy it is for a kid just to get hit by the boom or something, and, you know, that if that flowed through to the sport as you know, one of the safety changes, that'd be fantastic. So, yeah, look, I... what was the other question?
Oh, crash helmets.
Crash helmets?
Yeah. You got them covered.
About the wind.
The wind. Yeah, how much wind can you say? Well, these boats, like I said, they're pretty wicked up in about 5 knots of wind. I mean, once you get up towards 20 knots, they're definitely a handful. You sort of go more into, I guess, kind of, you know, a little bit of just trying to get the boat around the track and less sort of, you know, pushing it as hard as you can. We've sailed in quite a lot of wind in San Francisco Bay. The biggest thing with these boats we find is actually the currents. If it's a sort of a flat sea state kind of a day in the bay, like a flood tide, it's a lot easier. When the tide starts to turn against the current, that's when it makes it quite a handful out on the bay. But every day is different on the bay, but every day is rewarding.
Can I add one
Julian,
thing?
Julian, please.
So most people don't know that Jimmy Spithill was a helmsman during the now infamous very tragic Sydney to Hobart race of 1998, which was at that time the worst maritime disaster in Australian history. And he was aboard Ragamuffin, is that right? And came in third. So he has a history of sailing in challenging conditions.
Most
but
people probably also
young.
Don't know that Jimmy Spithill was once an aspiring boxer. What happened to that career?
Yeah, well, I sort of tell the running line that, you know, when you grow up with red hair, at some stage you will be boxing. You can't help but get involved in boxing. So, I loved sport, as a kid. And, I took up boxing just from, got sick and tired of sort of being the boxing bag. It was also, I think, a bit of a release. You know, I was doing so much more sailing. I played a lot of rugby, but the one thing that happened was that I met the guy at this police boys boxing club who was, you know, the coach there, and we just really got a very strong relationship. And he was just a real mentor in my life and really taught me about, you know, some key morals. And it could have been anything. I mean, I could have been there doing, who knows, I mean, it could have been chess, ballet, whatever it was, but the important part was that connection, you know, and it was sort of like a relief and almost like a second father figure to me. And, it's funny now, we incorporate a lot of boxing in our training, not trying to beat each other up, but sort of pads and this sounds random, but you don't get injured when you do boxing. And a lot of the weight training and the different stuff we do, guys can get injured. And boxing's all about hand speed, eye coordination, power to weight ratio, and that's what these boats are all about. You know, you make a mistake in boxing, it's pretty obvious what happens, you know, and the same with these boats. You know, you make a mistake and it's, you know, you get punished for it. So yeah, and I love sport. We have a lot of great athletes in our team too. We have guys who have been great rowers, we have some great rugby players, track and field stars, so really, really fortunate in the group we've got.
Let me go to some more of your questions that are coming in here. Actually, Norbert, you might want to field this one. It says, what do you say to people who think that the America's Cup should be limited to displacement hulls, that using these boats is like using tennis ball cannons at Wilmington? I like these analogies we're getting here.
Uh-huh.
I don't play tennis, so I couldn't answer that. But I can't say, like I was speaking earlier, the America's Cup was absent for 15 years out of this country. We lost it in 95 and it went to New Zealand, went to the great sailing nation of Switzerland, and then we brought it back after 15 years. And if it's like if you take a scale, in 1983, Dennis Cotter lost it to Ellen Bond. In 87, Dennis won it back. Went up and down, 95, San Diego. But then after 15 years, it just the interest of it kind of went out like this. And when we went in 2010, we were still there, but we needed to improve it. And like I said a little earlier, we took the forethought of getting out there, bringing people out there from kids to sailors to non-sailing enthusiasts, everybody out there to figure out what the best way to do it is. And the multi-hull was the way that we figured out to bring it back up to that plateau. Whether we remain there and go back to multi-hulls, I mean, or to the model halls, I'm not sure. We'll see what happens in September. And I mean that with all true spirit. But I think the multi-hall was something that needed to come about. And it's out there not only for the racing sailors, but also out there right now for recreational sailors as well, from small Hobies up to big 45-foot, 55-foot recreational cats.
Julie, you probably get this question a lot. How much money did Larry Ellison put up?
For his collective effort, or?
You're talking about?
Per America's Cup?
Yeah.
It's between, you know, $100 million, $200 million, you know, each campaign. But one astounding, that's the estimate. But there's one really astounding fact, and that is that USA 17, the trimaran that Oracle Racing won the America's Cup with Jimmy as the youngest skipper ever in 2010, that was a $40 million boat that was sailed in two races. So it was a pretty astounding fact, and that's the wing sail that was 230 feet high, too tall when standing up to fit under the Golden Gate Bridge. So, I mean, that was a pretty unbelievable boat as well. So this, my book goes into great stories about that. So the money, this is not an inexpensive thing. Yeah.
Look, member of the audience, Jimmy, has a question for you. What's the big difference driving a 45 boat versus a 72?
Well, the fundamentals are the same. I mean, it really doesn't. I mean, I come from a monohull background, and actually, interestingly enough, the majority of our sailing team were monohull sailors. But like most sports, the good guys are usually pretty good at adapting and picking it up. And you know, it's all about lift, drag, and balance. The big thing with these boats now is anticipation. Now, in the past, in the monohulls, you had a lot of time to anticipate what was coming up. You could talk about it on board, and you know. Now, I mean, you've got to stay a step or two ahead. And a lot of the times, we just can't have a discussion on what we're going to do. It really is just sort of like this. I mean, the fact is, on board, when you're doing 40, 45 knots and you're in 20 knots of wind, you've got 60 knots of wind coming over the deck. So it's very, very difficult to talk as it is. But yeah, it's anticipation sailing, I would say. It's a step or two ahead, and if you ever start to get behind, it's just like an avalanche. It is so difficult to try and catch up. When it starts to go bad, you start making a bad decision. Very, very tough to get back ahead of the rolling stone.
It's a kind of follow-up question from somebody in the audience who wants to know if you figured out a way to recover 72 after it capsizes. How can you get them back upright on the water?
Yeah, hopefully I don't have to practice that one too much, to be honest. I've already had a go at that. Wasn't as successful getting it back up. But the look, I mean, it's a fact. Multi-holes capsize. It's part of the attraction for a lot of the new audience in this event is that we are pushing it harder. I mean, if auto racing, if they had speed limits, probably wouldn't be that successful. People wouldn't watch it. But yeah, look, it's, I mean, we have a full safety team out there. You know, we have divers, we have medics, we've got the full chase boat team ready to go. The guys are wearing crash helmets, spare air, harnesses, knives, etc. for a reason. But I've got to say, one of the most memorable parts of this campaign, hopefully there's another one coming up in September, but one of the most enjoying ones for me was going through that experience at the end of last year where we crashed the boat, we got dragged well offshore, really, really tough situation. Looked like we were going to lose the whole boat. Anyway, we finally got back in the early hours of the morning. And it was a tough time for the team because when you learn about people, the best time to do that is in the worst situation. You know, when you're winning, it's like us, when we go and race and we win, everything's great. But when you start losing a few, you're a down match point, then you get to see what guys are like. And for us, this was the ultimate test. I mean, we just destroyed this boat that people had put blood, sweat and tears, hundreds and thousands of hours into it. And what were we going to do? And it was just incredible to see the team. You can either split apart, which some teams do, or do you pull the whole team, 120 people, pull themselves in and not play the blame game. Let's move forward. Let's learn. Let's rebound. And that's exactly what's happened. Now we're to the point today, we're sailing two AC-72s out on the water. And that in itself gives you a lot of confidence. because as we come up to this match, we, you know, and you can see it in the guys, they're like, well, listen, if we can get through that, if we can get through that terrible, you know, that really tough moment, a huge amount of adversity, what's going to stop us? And so that has been a very, very rewarding thing, and I think great for the team to get through. Obviously, back then, I never would have gone up to the guys and said, hey, guys, listen, I've got this great idea, what we're going to do. Larry, what we're going to do, mate, just crash the boat, you know, it's going to be great. Well, the team will be so much stronger. But anyway, as it turned out, we got through it. And, yeah, I think it's something that, you know, we really learn a lot about our people. And, you know, I was just really, you know, really honoured to be working with people like that that reacted that way.
Here's a question I know you're probably asked frequently, but I'll begin with the Commodore and then ask you, and then I want to talk with Julian some more about the book itself. How important is winning, somebody asks.
Oh.
Norbert?
To myself or to Larry? No, I think it's very important that we, I mean, that's what we're, it's a competition sport. You're not out there to lose the game. We're out there to win the game. And we're doing a pretty good job, and I have all my hopes up that, again, knock on wood, you don't tell people that you know you're going to win, but I have every intention that this team is going to do its best. Again, you're out there to win, and that's what it's all about.
Jimmy?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm the same as Norbert. That's why I'm here. That's why I get up, you know, do these long days on the water, every single team member, the guys there building that boat, working, burning the midnight oil. It's for the result. It's the win. It's that feeling of when it all comes together. I mean, man, if they could bottle that up, they'd be doing pretty well. It's you know, it's so hard, and I think that's why we get so obsessed with this. And it's, I mean, yeah, it's an incredible game.
I have to ask, Julian, what was it like sort of transcribing this whole, chronicling it and reporting it in a sense? Were you caught up in the race itself and the fervent sense of winning and all that?
I was really caught up in the people, in the human stories, the drama of whether it was Jimmy or whether it was Russell Coutts or whether it was Mark Turner, who's one of the heads of building for Oracle Racing, you know, dropped out of school at age 14 to learn the craft of boat building and is now the co-head of boat building for Oracle Racing. You know, and amazing stories. I came into it because I love the people stories. And, you know, the engineer who designed, who was largely in charge of designing the wing sail that I referred to, you know, USA 17. You know, a young French engineer who dreamed of one day being a part of a winning America's Cup, just like Jimmy did, but he didn't want to be on the boat. He wanted to design a winning boat. So I loved it when I started learning about all of these stories and how they came together around the America's Cup. And then, as I said, I became very interested in the history of the cup itself.
It's a pattern. Julian published a book called The Grace of Everyday Saints, which is also about ordinary people wanting to do extraordinary things and dreaming big and then succeeding and fulfilling those dreams. Yeah.
It is. So some people will say, well, what does your last book have in common with this one? But it is about dreaming big and following your dreams. And I like people who reach beyond what their comfort zone is, as Jimmy said.
But didn't you get involved in the race too? That's I mean, my sense in reading.
Oh,
it,
I did.
The way
I did.
It,
I did. And there
the
are these
the way the narrative moves. You're engaged in it in a way that writers can be.
And the high adrenaline race scenes where you feel like you're on the boat. And I definitely felt that way. I mean, I felt it was, you know, it's a little more thrilling to be out on the AC-45 for real. But I thought that you know, it's exciting. It's where the hopes and the dreams and the technology and the competitive spirit all come together. And, yeah, I did become, I loved it. Although sometimes I didn't love the writing of it, which you as a writer know. You know, it was a grueling thing. There was a steep learning curve, definitely.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
There's some questions about the way the timeline's going to run. When will the real schedule for July be released, and will Artemis race in July at all?
Leave that one to you, Norbert.
Sure, here we go. Artemis will race. They're going to be coming into the round robins at a little bit later date. The schedule has been released as of yesterday. It's on the America's Cup website, or as of this morning, actually. A little fewer races, but we'll get there.
Could trace the timeline as we're moving through.
Well, July 4th is the opening ceremonies. July 5th, next Friday, will be actually a banner day, because that's when we'll have all the 72s. We may even have both our boats out there.
maybe, yeah.
For a fleet race, which could be actually the first and maybe the last time we see that ever happen with the 72s, but it should be a wonderful day to see these big boats actually fleet racing across the bay. The race starts then the following Sunday with the first round of the round robins, and we'll go into July into August with the semis. The finals will start August 17th, and the winner of that final will be the winner that will contest Oracle Team USA on September 7th. And we'll race until September 21st. Best out of 19, first of best out of 17 and first of 9 to win, actually. Excuse me, on there. My math is getting a little backwards here. But we hope to defend the cup and retain it here in San Francisco in the United States.
And how's the Golden Gate Yacht Club doing now?
Wonderful.
Yay!
It's been a journey through the last 13 years. When we initially made our agreement and our alliance with, at that time, Oracle Racing. The cup is still made, even though it's here, the club has maintained its smallness. We are who we are. We're not going to be anybody different than that. I like that that the fact that we are still small and we're still a people's club. Has anybody been at the Golden Gate here? Raise your hands. Have you been there recently? You ought to drop by. Things have changed a little bit. We've done a little bit of a remodeling job. I'm very proud of that. And we've come a long way. We are a little legend that could. Considering where we were 13 years ago, I'm very proud of that club.
A little engine that had, used one of Julian's metaphors, a sugar daddy.
You call him anything you want. But some people call it savior, some people call it a friend, but in my case, I'll call it a friend of the club.
Yeah. I guess.
Had a good memory.
This is just a reminder, because this is being broadcast, will be broadcast, that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking to Jimmy Spithill, who is Oracle Team USA skipper, to Norbert Byron, who is Commodore of the Golden Gate Yacht Club, and to Julian Guthrie, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of the new book about the Oracle Team USA called The Billionaire and the Mechanic, How Larry Ellison and a Car Mechanic Teamed Up to Win Sailing's Greatest Race, the America's Cup. And you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV. And I'm Michael Krasny, your moderator. We probably reached the point in the program where we have time for only one or two last questions. And one of the people in the audience wants to know, this is to you, Skipper, what's the coolest new technology you're using now versus before?
I would say initially the wing. You know, you literally just pull. It's like pulling the wing off the side of a plane and just sticking it upright into a boat. It's the exact same thing. And the wing that Julian talks about from the trimaran last time is the biggest wing ever built in the world. You know, that's aerospace, airline industry, bigger than the A380 wingspan. It's massive. Huge carbon fiber wing. But today, I would say foiling. It is amazing. I mean, the feeling when you grow up being on the water every day and you're constantly looking at the water, obviously for the wind, but one thing is you're feeling the waves. You know, you're feeling the motion of the boat and you're trying to get that balanced out. And when you start foiling, it's just this sensation where the boat just lifts up and you just, it's like a turbo boost, off you go. But you get a powerboat or something go in front of the boat with a big set of waves or a big, you know, some wake. And you're sort of bracing yourself as you're about to hit these waves and nothing happens. And it is just the coolest thing. And you all sort of look at each other and you're just sort of smiling and it is the coolest thing. And it's funny, we've taken out a guy called Laird Hamilton, who's a big wave surfer. And he started doing this on a surfboard. You know, he had a hydrofoil under his surfboard. His big challenge was the waves are so big that he rides. He's going so fast that it's so choppy and it's hard for him to stay on these boards. That's what he's restricted by. So he went into foiling. And we took him out on one of our 45s that we were foiling on, and it was amazing. We all had the same connection. We came from different worlds, but we're both out there on the ocean trying to, you know, whether it be speaking with someone from the airline industry with the wing or someone like Laird Hamilton with foiling. The foils are pretty cool.
I'll give you one more question here. Somebody wants to know, number of days of training on 72 are limited. Do you have enough time?
Well, with these campaigns, you know, they can go for years, and you still start to get near the end, and you wish you had more time. I mean, initially, one of the cost-saving measures was to limit how much time you could sail your first boat. Now, as we've gotten closer to the event, it's pretty much open now and you can sail as much as you can. But yeah, it's a real trade-off. I mean, we generally try and sail 3 to 4 days a week. The guys train incredibly hard, obviously in the gym, but just a day's sailing is relentless for the guys sailing on board. The boats take a fair bit of maintenance, you know, we're constantly modifying them. And it's the age-old question, you know, you can design the boat as long as you can work on your design tools right up until the end so you get the right design, or you could design the boat earlier and sail it earlier and try and improve it by sailing time. Both have their merits, and that's one of the age-old compromises in the America's Cup is how much time do you spend design, how much time do you spend sailing. And now that we're out there on the water, it's obviously working with the design team, the boat builders, and hey, we could modify a lot of things, but any time we do some modification now, that'll cost us sailing time leading into the match.
Julian, what do you want people to particularly absorb from your book? I mean, this is a colossal effort, and the book is quite an achievement. I mean, the race, the characters, you've got all of that, the narrative, the history. Of what's most important to you as an author?
I think, you know, that it reads, obviously as a writer, I want it to read novelistically, as you say, that it reads very fluidly and that you read it and you love the writing and that you love the characters, or at least some of them, where you're very engaged, where you learn something, something new about one of these people that I've included, and where it's inspiring. You know, I think it is a story about dreaming big. So that's what I would want people to take away from it.
And that's what inspired you most?
It was it's multifaceted. So it wasn't one thing. It was Larry and Norbert and the Little Golden Gate Yacht Club and the building of these, you know, these high-tech flying machines. So it was all of these different components that I had to figure out a way to weave together in what I hope is an artful way.
Mm-hmm. And Commodore, what do you say to those who will say, well, we like the traditional kind of races more, these new high-fangled flying machines, as Julian puts it, don't necessarily thrill us the way what we're used to did?
There's other races to go to. You have to like it or not. We cannot implant in somebody's mind what's better or not, but I think you should give it a try and enjoy it. Incidentally, you spoke to Julian, how she felt about the book and everything. I'll never forget last year in our October America's Cup World Series, you came by the club. I saw a tear out of her eye after all these years of riding to see the whole race formulated in front of the yacht club there in the bay. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. I recommend anybody that has not been able to see the races to please come on out there and see it, because it will be the most exciting racing we'll ever have in the America's Cup.
Somebody wants to know, how tall was America's Cup?
How tall was it, or is it? Because it grows.
Yeah. It says, how tall was it? I think perhaps the better way would put it in the present tense, how tall is it? Yeah.
I don't know the dimensions exactly of the America's Cup. I know
that 4.5 feet.
4.5 feet. And it grew bigger under Larry Ellison's watch. Yeah. That's true. It's true.
This is true for most things with Larry Ellison.
Yeah.
And drinking champagne out of it is one of the greatest things.
Oh, yes.
Only once.
Yeah.
That we know of.
What do you think? Well, this is a very speculative question, but someone wants to know what you think will happen if another boat is badly damaged or another crew member is seriously injured or hurt. Will the racing continue?
Well, look, I think if you look in sport, you can never take away risk, and unfortunately you can't, no matter how hard you prepare, you can't stop freak accidents happening. But, you know, should we stop sport because of that? I guess that's the question. And for me, as an athlete out there, I say no. You know, I accept that there will be some risk. But what I learn about myself competing, what I learn about my teammates, the whole team going through this exercise, I feel makes me a better person, makes me a better athlete. That's why I'm out here doing it. And a lot of the time I learn a lot about, you know, myself. And that's, I think, well, for me anyway, that's what I really enjoy about life is going out and sometimes, you know, pushing yourself a bit and putting yourself under pressure, and then in the end, learning about yourself and hopefully learning some lessons along the way and becoming a better person. So, yeah, listen, I hope there are no more big accidents in our event and in the sport of sailing. Can I say it will never ever happen again? Of course not. Well, that's life, and that's what you sort of sign up for. But my take, yeah, I think sport has to roll on. It has to learn from it. But hey, that's sport, and it should go on.
Somebody asks, Skipper, he says, Jim refers to these boats. Does he mean that Oracle has backup boats?
We have two. So every team is allowed to build two boats and three wings. Every team except the Italian team have built two boats. Like I said, our main reason for building two boats is we don't get the race, so we have to sort of push each other and race a little bit in-house. The Challengers also have built two boats besides the Lunarossa team. You usually try and evolve from the first boat. You'll try and do that quite early, go out, sail it, and then incorporate a lot of those lessons into the second boat, and that's what a lot of the Challengers have done. And also, you need, you know, it's nice to have a backup boat. The fact that you have three wings, you've got spare wings, and that's really, you know, a lot of the reason for having the two-boat rule in there.
Another question for you, Skipper. Can you compare and contrast the advantages and disadvantages of being defender versus being the challenger?
Yeah, a little bit like I covered before. It really is, I mean, the fact you're in the final is a big one. I think the toughest thing for us is this in-house racing. I mean, we make a statement, kind of like a mission statement in-house, and we say, hey, we're going to try and get better in-house sailing and in-house racing than what the challengers get in their real competition. Now, that's a big statement. I mean, you can put all sorts of bets on the line and bragging rights inside the team for when you go out there and do some racing and some testing, but man, at the end of the day, it's a little bit like dancing with your sister. It's just not the same, you know. And, you know, it's not the, you know, when we turn up in September, it's, you know, you can sort of prepare yourself, I guess, for the Super Bowl, but until you go out of the tunnel and you run on the field and the whistle blows, that's our biggest challenge we have.
Commodore, in layman's terms, how the heck do these boats sail so much faster than the wind?
Aerodynamics. Basically, I think one of the most remarkable things I ever saw was when we were training with USA 17, the trimaran, back in 2009, before we headed off to Valencia, Spain, and the wing, bigger than a 380 like Jimmy described, was just placed on board, and I think you were out there sailing, and the report came back to the engineers, we don't see no difference. And what I understand is they came out there and they looked at you and they said, well, wait a minute. You don't sail a boat, you fly this. You never see a 747 pilot looking out the rearview mirror at his telltales. That doesn't happen. You got to fly this boat differently. And you picked it up by the way there.
Yeah, it's true. We initially, because we're so used to, with these conventional soft sailers, looking up and, you know, trimming it how we see it, where the wing has a, you know, a set of targets. And if anyone's flown a plane, you know, you've got some strict sort of stall speeds and stuff like that. So first day out, we go with the wing and, it's not that great. And, you know, of course we didn't look at the targets. We know best, you know. Took it on, and we came ashore, and we said, well, it just didn't seem to be performing. And Joseph O'Zane, who was that young design engineer in charge of the wing that Julian was talking about, sat us down and said, look, here's how you need to set it up. Here's how you need to sail with it. Sure enough, the next day we went out, and the thing just blew us out of the water. It was amazing. So, yeah, it was a big learning experience for the sailors. But now we're to the point where we don't really need to look at it. You know, now that we've done the time and everyone's got used to the wing, you kind of go off feel now.
And Jimmy actually went out and took flying lessons to better understand how to sail.
Right.
Yeah, well, I just thought, look.
Aerodynamics again.
Well, we were going to build the biggest wing in the world, and I just thought, man, how am I, what's the best way to understand the wing? And I thought, well, may as well get my pilot's license. So off I went and went down to Australia. I did it in 2 weeks and every day, which was a bit much, to be honest, but it is amazing how many similarities there are between flying and sailing, especially now. I mean, it's all about lift, drag, balance, and it's a well-set-up plane is very easy to fly. And the same with a boat. You know, a well-set-up boat is fast, easy. It means you can lift your head out of the boat and start to look around, and that's what's important.
Julian, you have hit the bestseller list with this book. As I said earlier, it's in the third printing. It's getting a lot of attention, a lot of very good reviews. Full house tonight. Just give us a sense of how you gauge the interest in the America's Cup as you've been on this national tour and everything. Are people really as keen about it as they have been in the past, especially defending the championship?
People have a lot of questions about it, you know, some of which are coming up tonight. And the big question is about the boats. You know, there's great interest in it. There's great allegiance to it. People are very wowed by I was privileged to travel this week and last week with the America's Cup trophy, the oldest trophy in international sports. And she travels in her own Louis Vuitton case. So she's pretty astounding to travel with. Excuse me. But the interest is great. Excuse me.
I ask the audience here, again, just to kind of get a quick gauging. Let's just hear audibly. How excited are you about the race, really? Commodore, skipper, music to your ears. Huh?
That's what I want to hear. But I tell you one interesting thing, too, in now that we have changed the boats, is especially when we've had these AC World Series down off Marina Green there, is kids, you know. I get this question, oh, but what about the old guys and they don't like these things and that? Well, honestly, is it about them? You know, is it them or the next generation? And the cool thing for me is after one of these races, big crowds, I'd go around, I'd see so many kids. Now, the majority of the kids I'd go up to, I'd say, hey, do you sail? And they said no. And I said, well, what do you think? You know, do you like these boats? And they just said, man, that looks really cool. You know, like, does that thing fly? And, you know, that looks like so much fun. That's a big deal nowadays. I mean, kids have a lot of options out there. You know, it's got to be fun. It's got to look cool. It's got to be cool to their peers, to their mates. And, you know, I think the best way to, you know, to answer that question is what does the next generation think? And, you know, from speaking with a lot of kids, especially the ones that don't sail.
What about your kids? They're in San Francisco schools. Are they all excited?
They are. They're quite young. They're 5 and 2. I've got 2 redheaded boys, so you could just imagine what it's... You know, I've got a strong wife, obviously. Look, they love the water. I mean, they're sort of at an age they don't really sort of probably know what's going on. But, yeah, look, I mean, that's another cool thing about the sport of sailing that I think if we can educate more people... It is an amazing, amazing sport. I mean, the independence it gives, you know, a child to go out there and go sailing, you know, to sort of break away from mum and dad. The fact you can do it as a family, you can go out there. You can do it at all sorts of levels, you know. You could do it on a cruising boat or you can go to the sort of Formula One to the very top if you want. But it is it's a fantastic sport.
This handsome young man up in the front here who's been turning over the timing for my... visual absorption of how close we are to the end here is Roman, Julian's son. How much is Roman interested in this whole world of sailing?
Well, you see he's wearing an America's Cup pin. Yeah. He's very proudly displaying it. He's going to have his picture taken with Jimmy.
We're going to have to get him some Oracle Team USA.
Yeah, exactly.
Commodore, what do you think about the next generation? I mean, in terms of sailing and interest in sailing.
Jimmy is spot on. The one thing that we've done, you know, we've come throughout this evening talking about the new technology on the boats. It's something. It's a really interesting platform for the young kids today. Non-sailing kids are getting more interested in it for the future of our sport, be it racing, be it recreational sailing, just going out there having a little fun on a Hobie, whatever it is. We got to get the children involved. And I'm talking from all cultures, from all nations. That's what's so great about the city of San Francisco, because we have that platform here. With what's coming up here, I truly think that we're going to get the sport backed up by the kids. They're going to want to sail in the future, and again, they're our future.
Well, and it's making it accessible, and NBC is covering the races live, so for the first time you're going to have this great publicizing of the races and seeing the races, you know, unfold on TV and over YouTube, and so it's going to be broadcast in a way that has never been done before, too.
Well, may I say the love of the race that all of you have and of sailing that all of you have is infectious and passionate coming through here. I want to extend thanks to our guest, Jimmy Spidhill, who is Oracle Team USA skipper, Norbert Byron, Commodore of the Golden Gate Yacht Club, and Julian Guthrie, author of The Billionaire and the Mechanic, How Larry Ellison and a Car Mechanic Teamed Up to Win Sailing's Greatest Race, the America's Cup. Thank you for enlightening and illuminating information that you've provided and for your passion this evening all about America's Cup race and coming to San Francisco again this summer. We also want to thank our audience here on radio, television, and the Internet, and here this evening at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Michael Krasny, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
That's good.
One more.